Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today at our Teletown Hall on COVID-19 testing. Very big, important subject that I know lots of people that I talk to are interested in. In the next 60 minutes, we'll provide you with an update on the county's effort on COVID-19 testing as it relates to the wider community and provide you with a snapshot of what's important and relevant to all of us. My name is Assemblymember Tasha Berner Horvath, and it's an honor to serve as your state assemblymember for Encinitas, Carlsbad, Oceanside, Vista, and Camp Pendleton. You know, when I took office, I never thought I would be leading during a worldwide pandemic, and since the governor declared a state of emergency due to the coronavirus in early March, the legislature has time and again voted to support our state's coronavirus response, as well as passing a budget that protects public health and education. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned, especially since being in the state assembly, is how much we work with our county partners. So today I'm very happy to have two great speakers who will talk about testing and the county's T3 strategy and really address all the issues on, I think, everybody's mind right now. So we also have Nick Mascione, who leads the County of San Diego's T3 initiative and is the director of the County Health and Human Services Agency. He'll be speaking about how the county is, you know, what's the County of San Diego's experience with testing been. As many of us know, it's the county that has the public health authority here in Encinitas, Carlsbad, Oceanside, Vista, Camp Pendleton. Those are all cities or areas, and the county does the public health. And so, Nick, thank you so much for joining us. And leading the San Diego County Office of Education is Dr. Paul Gothold, who will speak to us about the County Office of Ed's effort to reopen schools and address questions around schools starting virtually this fall. I know both Paul and Nick, I'm a mother of two kids. My daughter Maya is going into fourth grade, and my son Mate is going into eighth. And so I think we're all trying to figure it out. And I, you know, what I always try to tell parents is, we're in the middle of the worldwide pandemic, and I know everybody's doing the best they can right now. And if we keep that positive attitude, our kids will have the best positive attitude in going forward this year. So with that, both of our speakers are experts in their fields, and they have the authority and influence in their positions. They're true public servants working hard to ensure the quality of life for everyone. So I'm anxious to get started with our conversation today. But first, we have to take care of a little housekeeping. So before we get started, I want to let everybody know how our Teletown Hall works. Our guests will talk a little bit about their role in protecting public health during COVID-19 pandemic and when it comes to using data on testing, tracking, treatment, and explain how it supports working towards getting our kids back to school 5 days a week. Across the state of California, many residents have common questions when it comes to COVID-19 testing and how that data impacts school operations and ultimately parents, especially women, I think, getting back to work. I know my constituents here in North County have submitted questions, and we can discuss those to get some answers today. But to make sure our panel can be heard by everyone, participants are in listen mode. If you'd like to ask a question during the town hall, if you haven't asked it already, you could email assemblymember.bernerhorvath@assembly.ca.gov. So it's assemblymember.bernerhorvath@assembly.ca.gov. It's a little long. We're still working on a shorter one. And we'll do our best to address any of them today. Anything we don't answer today, my staff will try to get back to you, or we'll cover in a future town hall. This town hall is being recorded, and we're going to make that recording available on our website as of tomorrow. So let's begin by having our speakers take 3 to 5 minutes to introduce yourselves, briefly tell us about your agency and how your role has shifted in the last several months, and talk about some of the most common questions and concerns your agency has been getting asked. So let's start with Nick. Nick, want to take over?
Thank you, Assemblymember, and thank you for the opportunity for including me for this really important conversation. Nick Mascione, I'm the director for the Health and Human Service Agency, and been working with the county for the last 23 years. Proudly, I would say that the first 10 years, I was the deputy director for all of North County for Health and Human Services. So your district is someone, an area that I proudly served when I was there up in North County. The Health and Human Service Agency is really the whole cradle-to-grave safety net provider for our community. We serve 1.1 million San Diegans across a whole array of public health, human service programs, housing, behavioral health, and obviously public health and the fight against pandemics like COVID-19. As the Assembly member said, all of our worlds have been changed. I was asked to come over to the Emergency Operations Center in early May to really develop and build upon the work that was being done in the early months of the activation, being the first county, one of the early counties to declare a public and local emergency on Valentine's Day. And so in early May, I was asked to come in to really build out expanding our testing and tracing and treatment, as an Assembly member said, we'll talk more about. And that's what I've been working on since May.
Thank you, Nick. Good to know we have one of our homegrown heroes on the line and making sure that when we're walking, watching out for testing and how we're responding, that you have a North County heart there. So that's great. And then now we can move on to Paul. Paul, why don't you introduce yourself and tell you that's a little bit like what's the most pressing issue on your mind as it relates to testing in schools.
Thank you, Tasha, and thanks. Good to be with you again, Nick, and for the opportunity to be here today. So our agency obviously went into crisis mode in March, as Nick has described, and San Diego County Office of Education provides some oversight and support for all 42 districts. We have educational programs we run directly. Those are for some of our most vulnerable youth, homeless, foster youth, community schools, pregnant teens, and any kid or child who is incarcerated in the camps and halls, we provide direct educational services for. And our charters and a lot of time private schools will lean on us for specific guidance in areas. And really over the past several months, you know, we've had to respond to the needs of our community, and some of the things as that have drastically shifted and that we prioritized in our office were around food insecurity, the digital divide, mental health. Right now, we have are finalizing some agreements with Cox, Spectrum, and Verizon. Because of the economic uncertainty and the challenges some of our families and our kids are having, we will be able to act as the internet intermediary and pay a nominal fee on behalf of the families and get rid of all the bureaucracy and paperwork, whether that's in-home Wi-Fi or hotspots for children, through all three major providers. And that is going to be promoted and talked about in the next couple of weeks. That's available for all 42 districts that will be run in our office. We were fortunate to get the USDA and Secretary to grant a waiver around feeding of students. We found when we went into distance learning, so many of our kids rely on food from schools, and we saw longer lines of cars and a lot of individuals who didn't necessarily qualify for free and reduced lunch, but would under today's conditions. We were able to get that waiver, and along with the state support and Congresswoman Davis, there are several packages making their way through the Congress that we hope to have universal feeding for all of our students in need without focusing on the bureaucracy, again, of paperwork, but just making sure that we respond to our families who have been adversely affected. And then with mental health, we've really doubled and tripled down our efforts to make sure that we're providing really clear services in addition to academics. San Diego County has been selected as a state leader in training all other 58 counties in the area of suicide prevention, mental health. There are apps now that are available free of charge for that we're training teachers, and it actually gets down into the hands of the students for self-regulation. Any of the suicide ideation and things that that our students are experiencing, there's an additional layer of support. And then we've had to shift our delivery model with teaching and learning, where we've trained over 5,000 teachers over the summer on a variety of platforms, actually humanizing the online experience. And as it pertains to testing, you know, July 17th, the state came out with new guidance around health, and this is an area that is very new to us that we're still sorting through, working with county health to determine what that's going to look like in schools. But we understand that through the recommendations, that it is recommended that we test 50% of our school employees at least once a month, or 100% every 2 months. So that's where we are with that. There's a task force that's working on that as we speak.
Thank you, Paul. That is a lot that you've covered. It's great to know that San Diego County is a leader in mental health and suicide prevention. I know that's something, as you know, having a preteen, that I think really, sits on everybody's heart and mind as we are dealing with this very difficult pandemic that's causing more cases of depression and affecting people's mental health even more than it was before. So thank you both for your introduction. Thank you for all the work you and your agencies have done so far. I'd like to shift the conversation a little bit to take a step back and maybe ask Nick to start, and Paul, if you want to chime in. But Nick, can you explain the architecture of the T3, that's the testing, tracing, and treatment? And can you explain a little bit the architecture of the T3 methodology, and how are we gathering the data, and how does that help us control the spread of the coronavirus?
Yeah, thank you, Tasha. So our county is unique in the state that we took a slightly different path. You hear a lot in the national news and what the state talks about, testing and tracing, and that's important. But we actually have a third T, and that's treat. We took a population-based approach to our efforts, guided by the data of where the virus was going or was, as to where we needed to be testing. And so this is an integrated approach, because you need to know where you test, how you test, and much of our work was guided by health equity, and still is. And so in doing so, when you test and then you come across someone who is positive, then you have to what's called trace. And there's I'm happy to go further into that, but that basically it's finding the people who are positive or who they came in contact with. So we're doing an investigation and we're tracing the virus. We're hunting the virus to prevent from more people getting infected. And that's the importance of the test and trace. It is really a diagnostic and broad-based surveillance tool that's very important in public health. And you have to do it timely, and I'll be happy to go into more of those details. But the third T that separates us from most of the state is we do treat. So you come across people who, when they're positive, don't have a safe place to shelter and self quarantine or isolate, so they can get better and not infect others. And so we were the first, led by Supervisor Fletcher, with Supervisor Cox and our board supervisors, almost getting 2,000 public health. We call them public health rooms. They're basically hotel motel rooms countywide. And we secured these rooms to provide at no cost. In fact, our testing is free, our tracing is free, and then for folks that basically need and are not severely ill, that have to be hospitalized, mind you, but have a referral by their provider that's working with them that need a place to self-isolate, we'll give them a public health room for as long as they need it, 10, 14 days or therefore, and providing the well checkups, the behavioral health checkups, the food, the nourishment, so we can help these individuals. We've had over 1,200 San Diegans that have used our public health rooms. So this concept is really integrated of testing, tracing, and treating. And the data, as Tasha, as you've talked about, comes from and is derived from all these areas about how much testing we're doing, which tells us how many positive tests we have, right? Gives us indication of also where the virus is spreading, where there's hot spots or greater number of cases, as we call hot spots in our county, than others, to tracing, which is, how many staff we need to address that in a very linguistic, culturally responsive way. And also the number of different outbreaks that are happening that we're investigating and tracing. And then, again, the public health rooms of how many people need that help. In our treat, we also include the convention center. We are one of the three partners with the City of San Diego and the Regional Task Force of Homeless. We have about 1,200 unsheltered homeless at the convention center, have been there for many months now, and we're providing the care and the testing there. That's part of the treat umbrella. And lastly, I'll mention something unique I'm proud of. We added a therapeutic, I think the first in the state, using donated convalescent plasma. And so people who recover, who we now deal with, because we know and helping, right, in terms of the tracing, on a voluntary basis, once they heal and they recover, they can become potential donors from the San Diego Blood Bank, a partnership with them. They screen them, and they may be able to donate their plasma, their blood, that we take the antibodies and give it to folks that are very ill, and it's making a big difference. So in a very broad architecture, that's what the T3 strategy is for our county.
Well, that is fantastic. I mean, we just heard a couple of weeks ago, Gavin Newsom has come out with kind of taking your treatment strategy statewide. I don't know if we could go so far to say that. But it's good to know that, you know, we've tested it here and that we're looking at all the options. And it's good for folks to know that if you've been COVID positive, you can contact the Blood San Diego Blood Bank and be able to donate plasma. I have seen an advertisement for that, so that's really good. And it seems very holistic in a time where I think generally on the vaccine, we know very little. I think information is coming out every day, and you see these different studies, and a lot of them are very small studies, and so it seems like that is a very solid public health plan. So thank you for taking us through this. So one of the most common questions we have from folks is, I've been told I've been exposed to somebody who's COVID positive, or I think I have those symptoms. How do people get tested? Whether they have insurance or not, like, are there differences? What are the options for people to get tested?
Yeah, great question. We strongly encourage that. It starts first with contacting your medical provider. Every one of us is unique in our own health status, and we already know that if you have an underlying health condition, you may be at a much higher risk, right? So merely contacting your medical provider, it starts there. And that consultation with that medical provider really makes the determination of whether you should get tested. And then I'll happy to talk about what those options are of how we break down the barriers for people to get tested. But it starts with the medical provider. Some San Diegans don't have a medical provider. And so in that case, we encourage them to reach out to us. And it starts by calling simply 211. Dialing 211 free, toll free, and or going to the 211sd.org website. That's 211sd.org. And what happens is they'll be directed to a questionnaire. And basically, it's pretty clear when you come to our website. It's, you know, getting a free test. And I should make very clear, the state of California has testing sites. The county of San Diego has testing sites. We work close together. All our tests are free, no co-insurance, frankly, no barriers for them. Now, we do go through a questionnaire, a pretty quick questionnaire, to making sure, gaining some information, allowing you also as the individual to determine where and when you want to get tested. So we've added that capability. So if you are, for example, we have a testing site in Oceanside. We have one in Escondido. We're excited. We're going to be adding one next week up in North County, a drop-in site that doesn't require an appointment. But we give choices. And when they do this questionnaire, the reason why we will then give them our public health doctor to give them a order is that to get a COVID test, 19, in California, you need a physician's order. It's a diagnostic test. And we remove that barrier by providing the physician to give that order for those that don't have a physician. and ensure through our nurses that if their test comes positive, that we're linking that individual to a medical home. Often our federally qualified health centers or community clinics, which are fantastic, but making sure they are tied to a physician or a clinician that's going to work with them with that positive test, as well as when we do the investigation. So it starts with your provider. And for those that don't have a provider, we can go to that 211 website or call 211. But we also know there are folks that may call their provider, and their provider says, yes, indeed, looks like you are symptomatic, flu-like symptoms. And then they can come to our website, and we, help them find what's the based on scheduling, five-day-out schedules we have, what their preference of location, and they come in, and they'll get a free test, and whether they want to have a drive-up site or a walk-in site. I'm happy to go into those details, but it's free, and it's very important that we do get people then, once they are tested with their symptomatic, is to being able to self-isolate, because if they are flu-like symptoms, it doesn't matter whether you have that test or not. You got to make sure now you're not spreading it to anyone. So we always encourage people when they're coming to the test that they're going home and they're keeping that 10, 14-day self-isolation, looking for the symptoms so that they could obviously not spread it to others.
Well, I think that's a great point to say, if you don't have health insurance and you test positive, that you have to make sure you have a treatment plan. So there has to be some connection, and that's one of the benefits of going with you guys. And you said there's going to be a new drop-in site in North County. Are you allowed to tell us where it's going to be?
Not yet.
Not official yet.
Remember, but I will. You will be very proud of it. It will be along somewhere on the 70 corridor. It will be one of our large mega sites. We have been working hard to get one up in North County, so really how it's going to happen. It is a drop-in site. So, Tasha, what that means is it doesn't require an appointment. And so you can get the same day you have symptoms if you show up. Now, you might have a little bit of wait in the morning, but typically it's about 10, 15-minute wait during most of the day, a little bit longer in the morning. But it's the same day, and we are we have one already down in southeastern San Diego because of the major need. But we saw the need also in north, and so that's why we're going to have this site announcing it. If it hasn't been announced, it'll be announced very shortly, but it'll be available next week.
Fantastic. Well, we'll be waiting with bated breath to know where that is, because we do have a hot spot in kind of the ocean, some of the Oceanside Vista zip codes that I know I've been watching very closely on what's going on there. You know, we have another question from constituents. We hear repeatedly that there seems to be shortages of reagents and swabs, which is not surprising since it's a worldwide pandemic, right? And I know at first you had to only be symptomatic, but then they were, you know, we started testing people who were not symptomatic. And now we've closed back and we've gone back to testing only those that are symptomatic. Can you talk about what's the nexus between those different strategies as well as and how that relates to the availability of swabs and reagents and some of the other testing components?
Yeah, thank you. Excellent question. Indeed, there is a national supply. And tragically, when we started reopening the economy, we knew there would be clearly some people because of the, you know, not adhering to the public health preventive measures that we continue to in nauseam talk about the importance of. But we know just interaction, there would be more cases. We did not know it would far surpass and spike so rapidly. None of us did. And when this happened in our state, which, by the way, was the best performing state at the start of the epidemic, but when this happened, it really outstripped the production of all the, if you could think of it, all the things needed for all the stuff needed for labs to do tests. And this was compounded because it was also happening in other very large states. the same rise, Florida, Texas, Arizona, other states. And so it was a massive depletion of these needed things for the testing. Therefore, we had to, unfortunately, because we were one of the counties, you're right, Assembly, Tasha, that we were testing everyone, and that was our goal, was to try to test everyone that, you know, that clearly wanted to test. But we had to curl back, and we had to then, the state of California set guidance early on, the governor and Secretary Galley, our own county lab testing task force, which represents all our hospitals and the county and some of the fully qualified health centers, also met and said with our chief medical officers and lots of great minds and said, you know, we're going to have to tier this, and we're going to have to really test the most higher priority groups that need that test. And then if we can cover those, then get to these other categories of folks that may not be as severe. And so asymptomatics, to your point, people with no symptoms, we remove them from the higher priority groups. Because, again, if you're limited testing, you have to get to those that need it. So that was the reason. That's where we are now as a state. We hope that as supplies are replenished and things are caught up, that we can go back to maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, where we were really, you know, doing 10,000 tests, 9,000 tests on a 7-day average. We're down to 7,000 now, to give you an idea, because of the prioritization of the people who need it. So that's the reason for it. You know, you have to respond. This virus is changing. We have to change. We're learning as we go. But rest assured that we're testing the people that absolutely need to be tested and making sure no one gets missed there as we're then looking at how our supplies are going in the weeks and months to come.
Well, thank you for covering that for people. You know, I think I have regular conversations with a lot of people who are on your task force, and I think one of the heartening things that I've seen in this pandemic is how well all of the public health professionals and the CMOs at our hospitals and our public health clinics are really working together and coordinating with the county really to give us the best guidance and the best outcomes. So I know I feel very reassured when I look at that level of collaboration in what's very challenging time. So with that, I'm going to come back to testing as it relates to school, but I just want to make sure we you know, get to tracing a little bit. We heard that there was recently a contact tracer scam going about. How can somebody who has potentially been exposed to somebody who's COVID-19 positive and they get a contact tracer contacting them, how do they know they're a legit contact tracer?
Yeah, great question. And what we tell folks is, you know, if you do get a call, right away the individual calling you will represent themselves from the County of San Diego Public Health Services, will give you their name, will give you why they're calling. So you can begin to see up front the disclosure of folks, one. Two, what we always tell folks is it's okay if they say, is there a number I can call you back? We do have those phone numbers. There are some folks that, because we never want to lose anyone, obviously, who's just tested positive. And, you know, the devastation of getting that news, there's a lot going on in their lives when they get that, and now they're getting a call. And we want to make sure they're not getting scammed. Our disease investigations is really there to get information about really their close contacts. And they never ask about financial information. They never ask about, you know, Social Security or anything. That is a huge red flag. When people start getting into the financial information, they may ask about, you know, where you worked, you know, because they want to see if you had exposure in a workplace environment, but they never go. And typically that's where you immediately get the scammers. And we haven't heard much of that, by the way, but we know it happens. Inevitably it does in all these types of matters. But when they get into the financial information, we tell folks, whether it's our elder, financial fraud for seniors or people, victims, or in this case, COVID folks who are positive, we never disclose any financial information. That's definitely a sign of that is a scammer. The other point, by the way, is we also tell folks if they've gotten those calls to please report those. So we want to make sure we're reading out any of those fraudulent callers. Typically, their numbers are ID'd and they don't give any information. But if they get any of that, that's information I know that our district attorney always wants to know.
Yes, and on a previous Teletown Hall, we talked about contact tracing scamming, so and how that can be used against people. So this is like for our listeners, this is what you need to know. What I heard from you, Nick, is this. They'll identify themselves with the County of San Diego. They will give their name. If you ask for a callback number, you can call them back. That's always a really good trick on scammers. Scammers won't let you have a number to call them back on often. And then they won't ask for financial information. They're going to ask about your whereabouts, perhaps, or where you work, because they need to get that information to see if other people were exposed. Is that a good summary?
Excellent summary. And one more thing. We also know where your test came from. So when someone says, well, gosh, how did you get that? Well, from public health, it's statutorily required that they report it. Scammers wouldn't know maybe what testing site you went to, how they got that information. So right then and there, you can read out that that's not a legitimate person.
That is excellent. I think that's a really good piece of advice for all those out there getting tested. So we're going to take one more question on the tracing and testing, and then kind of transition over to schools. So Nick, can you explain some rates? So when we've been looking at the data, it appears that there's some community outbreaks that affect our Latino and minorities communities more than our other communities. Can you explain what you think's going on there and how you're dealing with that with our T3 strategy?
Yeah, thank you. Again, excellent question. We know that the virus has no borders and impacts us all. That's one. But it's impacting some of us more than others. What we see, for instance, is that by far, congregate settings, skilled nursing facilities, are at most adversely impacted. Nearly 50% when we look at our outbreaks are in congregate settings. And so that's alarming. When you look at also for restaurants and bars, that was another big area of our outbreaks when we reopened. So outbreaks occur throughout different sectors and areas, congregate settings, types of businesses. We are also seeing, in terms of cases, in South Bay, in our county, also adversely impacted. There's a number of contributing factors to that, whether it's very congested housing, or we also know that in South Bay, we have a lot of our essential workers. So when you look at just not healthcare or people working in SNFs, but people who are handling food and drivers and other essential jobs and roles, we have, and the governor's talked about this, a fair number of essential workers and most urban counties, they're in throughout, but we have a fair number in South Bay. And so they've been more at risk of exposure, even with taking precautions, because they're out there more, right? They can't necessarily shelter in place. They have an essential role. So all these kind of contributing factors is why we're seeing, higher numbers. And what that does for us, to your point, is that we need to make sure from the T3 approach that we have the testing. So about almost half of our testing availability is in South Bay, because that's where the cases are, and how we're doing a lot of our contact tracing, culturally appropriate, working with promotores or community outreach workers with the various cities and also nonprofit organizations with our county staff. So you have to adjust your strategy to the needs, and that's what we're seeing. But also you pointed out, for example, Oceanside. That's why we have a testing site in Oceanside, because we know if we're going to be seeing in our community, in our Samoan community or Latino community, or even parts of our African-American community, we need to make sure we have a testing availability. And that's in part, Tasha, why we expanded that other site now up. And I will just give you a clue and say it's going to be in between the Oceanside and Escondido. So again, to expand that type of testing availability of what we're seeing in North County.
Perfect. Thank you. You have us in great anticipation of what this is going to be. I think we'll have to do a social media post on that when it gets released, because you hyped it up quite a bit. And so as we transition from this idea of the T3 strategy, let's take it back and help people. You know, I pay attention to our county's triggers, and I think you guys have done an excellent job at identifying. I think there's 13 triggers that you're watching that help the public really quickly and visually understand where we are. And one of those triggers relates to the number of positivity cases, or COVID-19 positive cases. And that's also gotten us on the state's watch list, correct? That's the trigger that has gotten on the state watch list. Can you help our listeners and my constituents understand why do we have these triggers, why should they care about the triggers, and how that relates to the state's watch list, which then, of course, as a parent, relates to schools opening in person?
Yeah.
That's a big ask. But.
Well, and it's very important, because these are for the most part, standardized metrics. So triggers are these metrics that tell us how well we're doing, all of us are doing in our county in the fight against COVID-19. And whether you're looking at things that's happening in the spread of the public health issues, or how people are, getting infected, the epidemiology, or how well our hospitals and clinics and physicians and nurses and are able to treat those that are mainly, severely ill, the triggers begin to give you, in essence, a report card of how well we can reopen our economy safely, our schools. I know we're going to hear from Paul. Very, very important, because everything is tied to ensuring that we're creating a safe environment for all San Diegans. And so, but the triggers are secondary prevention. They're things that happen after the fact. You got positive cases or your case rate or outbreaks. It gets back to the way we address triggers is really through primary prevention. And at every press event we do and every opportunity, and I'd be remiss if I don't hear real quickly, give you the PSA, and that is, it is wearing that facial covering. It is washing the hands. It's the 6 feet distance. It's avoiding really the crowded places and congregate environments, and staying home if you're sick. And, and these are the things we continue to promote, because until we have a vaccine, and even then, these primary prevention measures are the ones that is the path forward to really address the metrics. And as a result of the restrictions we had to make, dialing back in dining and some of the personal services businesses and so forth, we're now beginning to see our cases beginning to come down and our severity of our ICE, very sick people going down, which is a good thing. And so we're going to have to make sure we're not in any one of these areas, and right now it's two, as Tasha pointed out, the case rate and the outbreaks. And so we're going in a good direction. It's going to take us some time still, but then once we are in all the correct safe measures, if you will, that sets us up ready. So when the governor decides to reopen, we'll be in good position and good stead to doing that thoughtfully.
Thank you. So we have these triggers. They're tied to letting us know how well we would be able to cope with any spike or surge that would come, the way we prevent those spikes and surges and keep our businesses open and reopen schools is the PSA. We do PSAs on all this all the time, is wear a mask, avoid crowds, keep six foot distancing, stay home if you're sick, and wash your hands. I always tell my kids, pretend you're Lady Macbeth and wash your hands for 20 seconds. So, you know, that's my little funny literary reference that I'm not sure my two children get yet. But so when we talk about reopening of schools in person, obviously it looks like, you know, my daughter's school starts, I think, on the 17th. My son's school starts a little bit more than a week after that here. So, you know, we're assuming we're starting in a distance learning mode. As I like to remind parents, regardless of what our personal feelings about opening and distance learning, our attitudes determine so much about how our kids will experience that distance learning time. And so even though, you know, I would rather my kids, you know, I'd rather there not be COVID, and I'd rather my kids be able to go back to school in person, that's not going to be reality for them. So my husband and I have sat down and we said, we're going to make this the best it can be, you know. And but when we think about reopening schools and creating guidance for reopening schools, Paul, can you take us a little bit through what the County Office of Ed has been doing on that? And what do you think really parents need to know about this initial reopening and distance learning mode and what a potential return to the classroom would look like?
Yeah, certainly. So I think number one, when we started to create this guidance, it was done through really a collaborative effort that included parents, students, teachers, administrators, county health. We had a number of folks at the table, and as we shifted into distance learning in March, one of the things that we immediately began to do was focus on recovery. So around that time, we were actually putting out planning assumptions and recommendations based on what we knew at that time. What would school look like with 50% of your kids on campus, 30%? And really the guidelines we were using is exactly what the PSA that was just mentioned from Nick. Because, you know, we're not health experts. And this is what public health said, you know, masks, distancing, sanitization, washing hands, all of that is loaded. You can access our guidance at sdcoe.net/COVID, and you will see every aspect of opening a school safely that has been vetted, that you know, through state agencies, mostly through our county health, around what we know to be true to keep kids and adults safe. So we have district representation on that committee, and really focusing on, you know, how can we open school under these conditions. And as you mentioned before, Natasha, the legislature was so key in preserving not only public ed, but some of the supports for schools around ACEs and after-school programs that may play a more vital role during the school day, assisting with minimizing class size or groups of kids in pods, with really, you know, trying to minimize the amount of areas that kids or groups of kids go in and throughout the school building, staying in cohorts, screening when you walk up through the school, keeping visitors at bay and not allowing visitors on campus. You can read about all these contingencies and things. In addition to, you know, what we also talked a lot about the last 6 months, and our training was designed over the summer for just this, was making sure that we had a viable distance learning program in place if we had to pivot back and forth. You know, we paid attention to some of the schools internationally and across the world that had a couple months lead time on. And what we found is in a lot of cases, they went back to school and then had to immediately close school. We also, you know, surveyed parents. So we understood there was going to be a population of parents who just did not want to send their kid back. They wanted to continue in distance learning. We had to have a contingency for that. So if it was a common thread through all of this, it was just to build a system of practice where we can offer a world-class education, regardless if it's in-person, distance learning, and be nimble and flexible and know that these situations are changing by the day. I'm a parent of two kids in public schools in this county, and they're 7 and 5. And, you know, it's just amazing to me how the health conditions not just in San Diego County, but in our state and country shift so rapidly and the response to that. And I know that our health, public health system and Nick's division is just on top of this. They are in front of it every step of the way. We are in consult with them on a daily basis to ensure that we provide the best information at any given point. But it's going to be imperfect, if that's a word to describe. It's not going to look like a traditional school under the conditions we're operating in, and that's just to ensure safety.
Yeah, I think that's imperfect is a great way. I also say it's a rocky road. You know, the next question I wanted to ask you is, what does it look like? What does testing look like? Do kids get tested before they go back to school? Because that would give me, you know, some reassurance, or once they go back into the classroom, sorry. School is starting and distance learning once they go back into the classroom. You know, will all kids get tested so that we know the people who our kids are hanging out with are at least negative at the time they go back?
I honestly do not know right now. There was talk about bundle testing, surveillance testing for kids. It's not in the state guidance. This is one of those areas where I would defer to Nick. I think the task force that's in place right now is what I described earlier that's in the state guidance, and that is that we test 50% of our children, I mean of our staff, every month. And that starts with the same pattern that Nick had described, primary health provider first, the public clinics that are open in this county second. But there has not been, I know it's being discussed in the task force, but I just don't have that information right now.
Yeah, if I may, Tasha, to build on Paul, and we have a great team, and Paul's part of that, working closely between leadership like Paul and the healthcare community and research community. Supervisor Nathan Fletcher led an item that was just approved this Tuesday by the County Board of Supervisors of $5 million for us to explore really innovative, cost-effective ways to do testing in schools. And there are some just amazing minds of researchers that have come together looking at number of ways, from wastewater to bundling to ways that we can really detect quickly and keeping people safe. But there hasn't been really any FDA, there's no magical, you know, kind of playbook. This is, again, proudly San Diego coming together and figuring this out together, because this is, as you said, the rocky road, no roadmap on this. But there's been the commitment to help schools and leaders like Paul coming together, sorting this out. And I think that's what's going to be happening now over the next, clearly the next many weeks with the task force that's looking at school testing.
That's great to know that the best minds in San Diego are working on that, because I, you know, just from my role in as an assembly member, I know there's, you know, that people have wide views on and perspectives on how we should do this and what returns to classroom looks like, but you know, to know that whatever we decide will be cutting edge, whatever we decide will be based on best practice and the best minds thinking about how do we keep our kids, our teachers, our staff safe with this. Because if we look at how we reopened the economy, the moment we reopened too fast, we got that spike again. And so I have to say, I worry about that. And I know our testing, tracing, and treatment plan has been very effective, but it's better to get, you know, make sure those outbreaks don't happen. Paul, did you want to chime in? Did I cut you off accidentally?
Oh, I was just going to add to that there, as Nick had mentioned, you know, one of the things that there are a number of companies claiming to do rapid testing. There are all these things that are on the table. Whatever agency that has been presented has presented some of these solutions to us, all of them are going to be vetted by public health. And so through this process, what we intend to do along with public health and this grant is to, you know, do economies of scale and bundle this so that individual districts don't have to kind of scrap and claw and figure out how they're going to do it, but we have a strong and cohesion plan as a county to support all 42 districts and our charter schools.
I think that's really fantastic. You know, when people, you know, I had, you know, friends, but also, you know, constituents call in asking about, you know, why can't it be this? Why can't it be this? And I said, well, you know, school districts don't have public health departments. You know, that's the county that has the public health department. And that's really where, you know, we've seen great leadership so far. I look at some of the other counties. There's a friend of mine does a county by county tracker. And you look, and as soon as we had that spike again, you know, the county took great leadership, and our numbers have come down. We went from 3 triggers being red to, I think, now 2. Hopefully that will continue going in the right direction. One of the things, you know, some of our constituents are asking is, what does it look like if when kids can go back into the classroom, whether that's hybrid or 5 days a week at full attendance, what happens if somebody tests positive? What does that look like? So what can people expect when the kids do go back to the classroom?
So the threshold is 5%, and if we're talking about a reduced number of kids on campus and smaller class sizes, that if there is one positive test per room, I believe the threshold is that classroom would be closed and followed by 14 days of quarantine. If a school experienced a 5% positivity rate of any combination of students or staff, the entire school would have to close with everyone subject to a 14-day quarantine. And if 1 in 4 schools in a district had a 5% positivity rate, the entire district would shut down. And then they would pivot and activate under distance learning, go back to that immediately.
So I think that's super important for parents to understand is that we're going to likely start in this distance learning mode, depending on when your kids start school and how long we're on the watch list. And if I'm not mistaken, we have to be off the watch list for 2 weeks before kids can even hope to return to the classroom, correct?
That is correct.
Yes. So then once the kids return, if somebody tests positive in that classroom, the kids can be home for 2 weeks. And then after that 2 weeks, potentially go back, and if it happens again, you know, I just think about, to be honest, as a parent, I think of the amount of notifications we got about pink eye or the norovirus or all the other things that we've gotten that tend to go around in schools. So really, schools could be opening and closing throughout the entire year until there's a vaccine or a therapeutic. Is that right?
That is correct.
Wow. I think that's really important for, you know, regardless of the best case scenario of getting our kids back to school 5 days a week, for parents really to think about. You know, I think there are some parents where maybe they have a stay-at-home parent and it's easier for them to manage that, but there's a lot of parents where that's going to be that kind of fluctuating schedule. I don't know how many people have jobs that are really, you know, in a two-parent working households that allow them to be home with their kids and then not home with their kids. That's a tough thing for folks to manage. Is there support that you're giving for single parents or parent or families where they have special needs kids? Are there considerations being thought of right now around how to manage that opening and closing with those families?
Yeah, you know, there's actually some guidance that's coming from the state around special populations. Our office, if you go to the resources that we talked about, the website, there is an entire section based on special populations. And for homeless, foster, special needs, some of our historically marginalized communities. And we're really trying to fill that gap wherever we can and provide the necessary supports, whether that's in person or not. You know, there's, like I said, the state is releasing some guidance even while there is school closure for small pods of these populations and coming to school in small groups of 8 to 10. And again, we're anticipating this to be released sometime next week. And that will, you know, it will change the county guidance and the health orders. But we know that there's going to have to be some contingencies and things that we do intentionally to support our most vulnerable kids, we've sought this entire summer. And so, for example, if there's outstanding assessments that need to be done through IEPs, there's going to be some conditions, even during school closures, where the child as well as the education professionals can conduct those assessments on campus. Some of the SDC classrooms being able to work in small groups of students. So I don't know the particulars, but they are coming out next week, and we will adjust our guidance accordingly once that comes out.
Well, thank you so much. I think this has been super enlightening to know that there's so much going on the testing, tracing, and treatment P3 strategy of San Diego County. Our San Diego Office of Education is working with our county to really lead the charge on how to interpret some of the state guidance for what that means locally. I know different school districts have some flexibility in there, but again, as I said, they don't have public health departments. So they really turn to both of your agencies to help them understand how to do how to do education in the next year appropriately. So I want to really thank you both for really leading us through, this changing environment. And I think what I'm going to take away from this is what I have the opportunity to learn this year is flexibility and adaptability. And those are things that we can take this opportunity to teach our children too, because the more adaptable and flexible they will be, the better they'll be able to adjust to the opening and closing of schools. And that goes for us, too, with our economy. Sometimes we're working in the office. Sometimes we're teleworking. So really that's the opportunity that we get to learn from this next year. And with that, I'd like to go to our closing remarks. I've generally been really good about keeping this to 60 minutes, but this is a fascinating topic and great discussion. So I'd like to turn over, maybe we'll start with you, Paul, and then go to Nick for your concluding remarks, 30 to 60 seconds.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of competing interests when it comes to the opening of schools, and really we are taking the lead from our health experts and doing the best we can to accommodate everyone. One of the things that I did not mention in my opening comments that I think is important is that this has affected us. Every single individual has been affected by this, regardless of zip code or anything else. And one of the things that we have stressed in our office is providing the space, to have some healing. And not just on our office, with some of my African-American colleagues and others who have gone through some pretty challenging times and helping their own children navigate a lot of this. But, our kids have a lot of strong feelings about what has been going on in our society the last 4 months. And just to jump into the academics, it just doesn't seem right. We need to figure out how we have a really successful orientation of bringing teachers back to make them comfortable and let them talk through their own experiences, but also how we facilitate that with our children. Because during this time, we have to double down and make sure that, our kids know that we love them, they need to feel connected, they need to feel engaged, and particularly in this time, and for some of our kids that need us the most, we just have to double and triple down on that. And really, we don't see ourselves as just educators, but looking at children holistically and doing whatever it takes to meet their needs, and we will continue to be committed to that every single day that we are going through this. So I appreciate you so much, Tasha, you as well, Nick, for the opportunity to talk today. And we will get through this. We always say that. We will. But I know that just through my experiences the past 4 months, there have been so many acts of kindness, of inspiration, of people helping each other. And that leads me to believe we're going to be very successful coming out of this. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. That was very inspiring for me. So, Nick, you have to top that with Paul's great, inspiring
question. I always hate following Paul, Tasha, because he is phenomenal and his words, but it also it's his words to deeds. And so we're very fortunate in having his leadership. There's a African proverb to go fast, go alone, to go far, go together. And what much of what we're talking about is that we need each other to get through this and to go far. And, you know, we are celebrating our 10th year of Live Well San Diego. This is our population health strategy in San Diego. And we know, and Paul, you know, been a very big part of our whole Live Well movement. And that's simply, look, we can only live well when we all live well. And right now, we do not have. We've lost lives of San Diegans. We have a lot of people suffering economically, mentally, socially, physically. So the way really forward of us coming together of this Live Well moment is getting back to the basics. And the basics here is if we were, and all the science tells us, if we just follow the public health precautions of keeping ourselves safe with our facial coverings, our physical distancing, our washing hands, staying home if you're sick, avoiding large gatherings, if we all did that as San Diegans, if we froze that in a moment and did that over weeks end, we would even see sharp decreases across the transmission of the virus. So my wish is that that happens, and it's calls like this and communications, and thank you so much, Tasha, for helping get the word out in your leadership and protecting and helping us in San Diego. I think we have a lot more work to do, but it's doing it together, San Diegans. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And I want to thank you, Nick Mascione and Dr. Paul Gothel, for joining us today. And thank you for all the participants who are listening and learning more about San Diego County's testing and educational environment during this pandemic. I think what we can all take away is there's a lot being done and there's a lot more to do, and the things that we could do are wear a mask, socially distance, wash our hands, and stay home if we're sick. And that's the best way to get our kids back in the classroom. But we should also all be preparing for a pretty rocky road ahead. You know, I sometimes worry when I talk to public health officials that we haven't seen the worst of this virus. And so just, you know, remember that we're a community and that we're better together and we're stronger together. That's the things that I'm taking away. So I look forward to continuing to work with both of you and your respective agencies. As always, my office is here to assist and welcome any of our constituents' questions, comments, and concerns. My goal is always to provide the highest quality of public service on state-related matters. If you have any questions that you think of later that were not asked today, please email myself. My district director is Janet Chen, C-H-I-N, at asm.ca.gov. That's Janet.Chen at asmca.ca.gov. Or my field representative, Alex Kiwan, Alex.Kiwan, K-I-W-A-N, at asm.ca.gov. Or you could call my office at 760-434-7605. We're also here to help with any of your and all of your EDD, unemployment insurance benefit questions. I know we have a lot going on right now. We're pushing really hard on EDD to make sure those UI claims are being fulfilled, being paid out. We know people in our district are really hurting right now. For more information on these teletown halls or to listen to this after the fact and share with a friend, you could go to my website at www.a76.asmdc.org. That's www.a76.asmdc.org. And you can get an archive for this or any other of our town halls. We have some helpful links. We have www.sandiegocounty.gov. That's an easy one. Doesn't need to be spelled out. So you could go there, find out all the information that Nick was talking about. But you could also go to www.sdcoe.net to the San Diego County Office of Education website to hear everything that Paul was talking about. So thank you very much for both of you for your participation. Thank you to our listeners. And have a safe and enjoyable evening, and stay safe, North County. Thank you so much.